Tov. Alrighty, so let's continue in Lonely Men of Faith. We left off last week. I mentioned to you sort of a trajectory of what we're going to be doing. We're holding on page 6. Oh, we all have different pagination. In mine, it's page 6. The paragraph begins with the words, "as a matter of fact." I think we read it quickly, but we're going to read it again. The paragraph, "as a matter of fact." So the Rav is presenting... Again, the loneliness that he feels, and we spoke about the special type of loneliness that the man of faith is destined to feel, which he has yet to define what that is. But he said there is that loneliness. There is the objective of what it means to deal in the world as a man of faith, which is, of course, what's going to be relevant to all of us and those of us that we love. But then the Rav said to us yesterday that the loneliness of which he speaks has two sides to it, two sides of one coin. He says there's an ontological inner loneliness of the gavra, that the person himself within himself, by definition of being, by virtue of being a man of faith, there's an objective reality that comes from the subjective connection that a man of faith has with God. Therefore, there's an objective reality of him being lonely. But then the Rav says there's a second type of loneliness that comes from this man of faith's place in the world, and is having to deal with the world and what the Rav called the historical situation and all its whimsicality, all the changes of the world itself. And it was not an internal loneliness, but loneliness that actually comes from being within the world itself. And you remember we mentioned last week that the Rav in this book is very much dividing the inner world and being in the outside world, as opposed to halachic man, which we spoke about and haven't gotten over Yeshir Shimon Kehelis, Marshall, because it's Gevaldik. But so to speak, as opposed to halachic man, where the Rav sets out on merging the two, the phenomenology of the experience and superimposing them in the world in a Fichtean manner, in this book he's very much speaking about this dichotomy, this dialectic of the inner world and the outside world. And then after the Rav said that there are these two sides of the coin, then the Rav says as follows: as a matter of fact, the investigation at the second level, meaning the man of faith in the world, in the chefts of world, not in the gavra of self, is my prime concern, since I am mainly interested in contemporary man of faith, who is, due to his peculiar position in our secular society, lonely in a special way. The Rav says that in today's day and age, there's a special loneliness because of contemporary man's situation, and that's what he wants to mainly reflect on. No matter how time-honored and time-hallowed the interpretation of faith and loneliness is, which beautiful that he says that it's an honored and a hallowed faith. It's like it's almost like a holy faith, a holy loneliness. It's a hallowed loneliness. It's a loneliness that's a holy thing. So no matter how old it is, how eternal it is, how honored and hallowed it is, the interpretation of faith and loneliness is and that it's always been around by Jews.
Yeah,
and
interpretation?
I'm sorry? Interpenetration, I'm sorry. Time on and time out, the interpenetration of faith and loneliness is, and it certainly goes back to the dawn of the Judaic covenant, which we learned last week, is by Abraham, but contemporary man of faith lives through a particularly difficult and agonizing crisis. So the Rav says that he wants to say that this essay is most primarily for man of faith in contemporary society in today's day and age. Let me spell out this passional experience of contemporary man of faith. He looks upon himself as a stranger in modern society. So the Rav is saying that the first thing with the loneliness, not the internal, but the external, the society loneliness, comes first and foremost because he looks upon himself as a stranger in modern society, which is, number one, technically minded, number two, self-centered and self-loving, almost in a sickly narcissistic fashion, scoring honor upon honor, piling victory upon victory, reaching for the distant galaxies, and number three, seeing in the here and now sensible world the only manifestation of being. So again, the Rav is saying three things that why man of faith looks upon himself as a stranger in modern society, which is technically minded, and it's self, number one, it's technically minded. Number two, it's self, so we have to, what does that mean, why technically minded? Why would that be a problem? Why would the fact that he's in modern society, why would technically minded, why is that a problem? We need to explain. Self-centered and self-loving, almost in a sickly narcissistic fashion. Now, what does it mean, self-centered and self-loving? So I don't want to make too much of a comment on the state of man in today's society and everything, but I'm sure everyone knows that the amount that we are caught up in ourselves is infinitely and incomparably more than previous generations, and for good and for bad. I'm sure many of you are met from a couple of generations back. I know my grandparents, and I'm sure many of you, some of your parents or grandparents, are You know that people back in the shtetl didn't sit in therapy for 6-7 years or 20 years and try to come to their inner selves, right? They didn't deal with those type of things.
They didn't have to go to Europe to look for themselves either. They were there.
Right. They didn't have to go anywhere to look for themselves. They didn't feel that there wasn't this being caught up of being in touch with one's feelings and the true self. And I'm not going to comment on whether yes, I am. And I'm not going to get caught up on the fact that, of course, that like anything in life has benefits and negatives. Like anything in life, everything in life always has a plus and minus to that. So, you know, again, we could spend an entire class talking about that, but I'm sure we could have a group therapy session about that as well, about the fact that we're so caught up in ourselves and what that means and the difficulties it imposes upon ourselves. But on the other hand, there are a lot of positives about it. Because I'm sure, Rabbi Weinberger told me that Rabbi Saul Levitz, who used to live with me, who was one of the founders of Eish Kodesh, so he actually gave a talk to, I think, people that were dating or something a couple of years ago. And Rabbi Weinberg said he was there, and here Dr. Levitz said, he's founded a very chashuva institution in Yerushalayim from therapists. So Dr. Levitz said like this, that in the shtetl 100 years ago, when people got married, the only thing that really bothered them was that it would be a partnership that would work, you know, utilitarian. That, you know, there was a partnership, and that was the, you know, financially made sense. It made sense in, you know, very, very, very simplistic, tachlis-oriented, you know, issues. That was really what mattered. If by perchance that the two people would end up being friends, that was bechlal a plus. That was even better. That was like mamish. That was like unexpected, you know. And then, but if they would end up being mamish, that they would love each other and they would be in love, that bechlal, that was like. And I'm sure I don't need to tell you. Everyone knows. All you need me to say is, after 25 years, I've washed your clothes, made your bed, right? You all remember what I'm talking about, right? Do you love me, right? So you all know what I'm referring to. So there wasn't all these issues of having to deal with self. There wasn't the narcissism and self-involvement in previous generations, but I got to tell you, we all know that there was also minus to that back then. People were, you know, again, I don't want to get off track, but there were people that were very alienated from themselves in a lot of ways. Which is why the old European rebbes or people that came to America had no common language with people in America. There was like no common language. So the sense certainly in contemporary society is self-centered, self-loving, almost in a sickly narcissistic fashion, the Rav says.
He's saying this 50 years ago.
And he's saying this 50 years ago,
before
correct.
Before Facebook, before Fitbits, before everything.
And before it was a pride to say you have a therapist. Today it's almost a faux pas to say you don't have a therapist, right? Mm-hmm. Back 30 years ago, it was still like embarrassing to admit you have a therapist. Today it's like, what do you mean? You don't go to therapy? It's like, that's a faux pas, right? So today the Rav is saying, this is in the 60s, he's saying, but that's the way society is. It's self-centered, self-loving in a sickly narcissistic fashion. And then the Rav says, number three, scoring of honor upon honor, piling up victory upon victory, reaching for the distant galaxies, and seeing in the here and now, sensible world, the only manifestation of being. That's a third thing. Technically minded, number one. Number two, self-centered, narcissistic. And number three, seeing in the here and now, sensible world, the only manifestation of being. You speak about to people in contemporary society, now I got to tell you, like I mentioned this quickly last week, I think it's changed over the past 15, 20 years, honestly. But let's just say what the Rav is saying, mainly society today is, go talk to people today about, you know, the world to come and Olam Haba, distant realms. These things, people are not aware of that. So the Rav says, so these are the three issues that contemporary man has to deal with. So the Rav says, what can a man of faith like myself, living by a doctrine which has no technical potential? There's no technical potential in the doctrine of a man of faith. Right? You're not going to end up like, the man of faith is not going to end up inventing, you know, a better way to have an iPhone. It's just not going to happen. And you all know, one of the reasons that religion lost so much street cred, you know, street credit? Mm-hmm. Street credit, right? One of the reasons that religion lost so much meaning in people's eyes is today people define worth based on technology. If you think about it for a second, again, based on what the Rav is saying, we'll see, we're going to talk about this a lot more, but people define things of what could it do, what's the technical potential. And let's talk for a second about why people go to college these days, most and foremost. How many people do you know go to college because they want to explore the deeper meaning of life? How many people go become doctors today? I'm sure there are more than like in other fields, but I'm sure there's a great percentage that become doctors today to make a living. But they're not looking for the noble, you know, how many people actually, you know, people go to college for utilitarian purposes. As opposed to universities hundreds of years ago, when the universities began, when the concept of universities began in the Middle Ages, in the 12th century, it was primarily theological based. It was primarily based on a search for truth and, you know, humanities, etc. So today people define things based on technical potential. Technical potential, and religion has no technical potential. So the Rav says, what can a man of faith living...
That we know
we,
of.
Huh?
That we know of.
That we love and we know of and in our foreseeable future, right? Nobody ever invented something based on a Blat Gemara. Nobody ever invented something technology based on religion. It just doesn't happen. That's not the story of science. The success of science, again, people define the reason that religion lost credit is because science has made the world technologically advanced, and religion didn't. In fact, again, this is Christianity's problem, not Judaism's. It's Christianity's fault. But you know, historically, Christianity did everything that they could in the power to impede technological and scientific progress.
The Dark Ages.
Huh?
The Dark Ages.
The Dark Ages and science, I mean, I don't need to tell you, that was... Christianity impeded the progress of man for many, many years and almost fought, you know, burn people at the stake for that. So it's not just that it doesn't have technical potential, but it seems to impede it. Says the Rav, living by a law which cannot be tested in the laboratory. Living by a law which cannot be tested in the laboratory. Now what does it mean, a law that can't be tested in the laboratory? Can't be tested in the laboratory means, as much as we like, you know, in the discovery seminars and all these type of Kiruv type of things, where we like to pretend that Judaism could be empirically proven with codes, nice. Bible codes, that's neat and nice and cute and it's laboratory, it's not. It's stupid. That's not true. And that's why at the end of the day, actually, just Rabbi Weinberg, he did me the favor of bringing me to speak to some of his chevra. And I spoke to them a little. You could speak a lot more about it. But the biggest issue is that people today define things by what could you prove to me? What could you prove to me? And people want to see what could you prove? Now, the truth is you can't prove really anything rationally. But people define things by what's true is what happens in a laboratory. Now, anyone that knows quantum physics knows that even what goes on in a laboratory is not the ultimate reality. Right? Quantum physics showed us that what goes on in a laboratory is not ultimate truth. It's also only based on what we see empirically. You know that, right? Quantum physics says that what goes on in a laboratory is also not ultimate truth.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is not what the Rambam says. The Rambam states that the only thing that cannot be proved is God, and that's because it can't be demonstrated. But everything, and even God, can be proven rationally through the logic, through logic and rationale.
Wait, can or cannot, you say?
Can.
And what did you say? The Rambam says the only thing that can't be proven is God and everything else can. What does that mean?
Everything in its essence, because everything can be proved logically.
What do you mean everything? What are we talking about?
Anything that can be demonstrated through logic can be proven by logic. In other words, you're saying things that can't be proved in the laboratory as we see it, but through the laboratory of the mind or through logic, it can be proven.
Well, again, you have to remember
that's what the Rambam posits.
Right, so first of all, the Rav is very much going after Kant, where, and I mentioned this already last week, that pretty much we don't think that logic is something that's foolproof anymore. Modern man does not believe in the fact that logic is foolproof. The Rambam was going that it is. Modern man does not. That's number one. Number two, believe me, I have respect for the Rambam would be an understatement. You know, the Rambam, you know, halavai, me and my children should come up to the holiness of the dust under his toenails. But the Rambam's model of the universe, I don't want to say has been disproven, but certainly science questions very much. The Rambam's science is based on Aristotle and a certain model of the universe, which the laboratory, quote unquote, has disproven. So I'm not Chalila, I believe every word in the Rambam is Teres Emes, and how that fits with science, that's a different issue. But the point the Rav, I believe, is making over here is that people today base things on what lemaisa, tachlis, what happens in a laboratory. Is it something that is actually you could see with your physical eyes or not? That's how people define reality in today's day and age. Again, I do think that today the past 20 years is different. I think people are a lot more open to mysticism in today's day and age. I think even in therapies and even in very mainstream places, people talk about mindfulness and energies, and I think that people are more open to the pararational and suprarational. But certainly, people today are defining things. Again, but that the mainstream certainly defines things by what could be proven in a laboratory, tested in a laboratory. And God can't be tested in a laboratory.
Why is that necessarily true? What if I said to you, let's do an experiment, let's see if more people who daven, you know, the people who daven get cancer as much as people who don't daven?
That doesn't prove anything.
Why not? If davening is real and has an effect, it should be.
There's variables that you can't even quantify.
That's the sunspot theory fallacy. In other words, just because you can correlate something statistically doesn't prove that one thing is related to another.
Okay, well.
There are so many variables involved in that it would be impossible to know. I'll just get... You have a guy that davens every day but steals money. You ever hear of a frum Jew that steals money? You ever heard of such a thing?
It says in the Gemara that this is an old thing, right? Doesn't the God have prayed that his gonifery will go well?
Exactly, no.
So that's...
So what are you going to base it on? By whose praise?
You'd have to be God.
There's no way. You have to be. You could pray, but then you could be a bad person. There's no way to test something like that. Come on.
He's writing this 1965, and the 50s and 60s, like post atomic age, was the age of science. Women stopped nursing because they thought.
Yeah, but I think it's even true today. I mean, I think today people. I think it's still people go by what the laboratory says. But one thing for sure, we agree that our law can't be tested in a laboratory. There's no way you can't test halach in the laboratory. You know, we could pretend that it's healthier to have circumcision and to have kashrus. The bottom line, there's no way to prove any of these things in a laboratory. Right, they're steadfast, and this man of faith lives in a way of steadfast in his loyalty to an eschatological vision, Mashiach, whose fulfillment cannot be predicted with any degree of probability, let alone certainty. Right? We live with an eschatological... We live... Our whole lives are about waiting for Mashiach. My grandfather, Zichron Levracha, used to always say that one of the jokes that they said in the shtetl is that a Jew came to a town, a new town, and he said he was looking for a job. So they said to him, we could give you a job. We have a position that actually just opened because the guy that had the position just died. We have a position that's available. It pays very little, but you're guaranteed it's a lifelong career. And that is, we pay a person to sit by the gate of the town to tell us when Mashiach's going to come. So you're going to sit by the gate and wait for Mashiach to be the one that's going to tell us Mashiach to come. So it pays very little, but you're guaranteed it's a life thing. So the Rav says, and you know, as much as, you know, Lubavitcher Rebbe 22 years ago, everyone knows, was screaming and yelling, Mashiach's come, Mashiach's come, Mashiach's coming. And I'm sure you all remember, everyone was pretty sure that Mashiach's on his way, that the Rebbe said, it's happening. So we're living with an eschatological vision, which cannot be predicted with any degree of probability, let alone certainty. And yet we believe with Be'emunah Shleima B'Mashiach. You know, Jews went to the gas chambers singing about Mashiach coming. They didn't sing about Olam Haba. It's very interesting. The Jews didn't go, you know, the song that was popular in the camps was Ani Mamin that Mashiach's coming, not Ani Mamin that I'm going to go to heaven. Because our Jewish collective national hope and dream is not for an individual reward in the world to come. You know, that's just, what do you call when the baseball players are waiting to hit the ball?
On deck.
That's just people, the neshamas are just on deck. We believe that what the Judaism is about is this world. The eschatological vision of the Messiah. That's what our whole religion is about. That's what everything in Judaism is about. And yet it can't be predicted. Even by the most complex advanced mathematical calculations, says the Rav, what can such a man say to a functional utilitarian society? He becomes especially alienated and lonely. What could he possibly say to such a society, functional utilitarian society, which is saculum-oriented? Saculum is a type of time measurement that you measure time very much based on pragmatic issues of how you measure in this world. In other words, saculum means that you quantify even time based on humanity's perspective. And whose practical reasons of the mind have long ago supplanted the sense of reasons of the heart. Look how beautiful. The society whose practical reasons of the mind have long ago supplanted the sensitive reasons of the heart. And again, the best example of that is that even you speak to people, how are the humanities doing in universities? The humanities departments. The humanities departments, even... Huh? They're not doing so well in university. They're really not doing so well. People go to college, university, very much degree-oriented and technical-oriented. So it's practical reasons of the mind supplanted the sensitive reasons of the heart. So what can we say to such a society?
Something of the marriages that you were describing before. It was much more practical-oriented than heart-oriented.
I think what the Rav is saying is that all in all, when it came maybe to marriages and things of... They looked at marriages and relationships a lot more maybe utilitarian. But I think all in all, people were much more looking for meaning. You know, everyone, all philosophers from the 20th century have already been saying that what people stopped looking for is meaning. And people back then, you know, if we speak about, let's say, our Alte Babes and Zeitzer Alte Zeitzer 100 years ago in the shtetl, though they might not have had love at home, and they might not have had meaning, they didn't have a career, and they didn't have like a midlife crisis, and you know, people say, you know, good doctors and lawyers and have midlife crises, and yet they lived with a certain, there was a certain meaning, there was a certain overarching meaning that the heart was telling them something. Like the Rav speaks about in Halachic Man, in the footnote, it's one of the interesting things he actually brings in a footnote in Halachic Man from the famous story of Yud Lamed Peretz. You know, the famous writer Yud Lamed Peretz, that he speaks about how this orphan boy who had the horrible, wicked stepmother and this horrible life, he had to beg his stepmother for another turnip for dinner, was praying Kiddush Levana that the moon should be full. That the Rav speaks about that there was a certain, like, overarching, you know, meaning in life, and it was all about, you know, whether it was for the king or for the religion. People had a place in society. They felt that there was a reason, there was something about it. And there's a certain sensitivity that today people have lost in some ways.
This question might be premature, but does the lonely man care that he can't talk to society? Is he lonely because he just doesn't have a language of communication with society?
And as he was saying,
he has what he wants. He has his Torah, he has his mitzvahs, he doesn't care that.
So we spoke about this last week. I don't know if you heard. We spoke about this last week. That the Jay spoke about it, whether a person could run away from this. So, but the Rav very much does speak about having a dialogue with society, not running away from society. So therefore, by definition, it's going to be affected. The loneliness is certainly affected by what society says. Yeah?
Okay. Is he sad that society doesn't...
Yeah. We'll see. We'll talk about it. We spoke about this. We actually spoke about this at length last week. But that's very much part of that. The idea is to bring truth to other people and bring God to other people. We spoke about it last week. So, b'chol ofen, so what I want to talk about now, and I want to spend some time. Ad Khan is the questions of the book. Now is going to be the biur. Now really begins already. The next paragraph already is the preface to the biur, the main explanation of the book. Until now, we really said the question. And the reason I want to bring in Heidegger and compare is because what's very important, to really understand something, the real way to understand an answer is by really being able to quantify and clearly delineate what the question is. You know, they say in learning, they say, if you could say the question well, you already have half the answer, right? If you could say the question well, you already have half the answer. I remember, you know, especially in Brisk, there's a stress on the fact that you could say the question well, that to phrase the question properly, you know, that itself is half a good teshaila is half a teretz. I remember I was learning... I spent 2.5 years, two years and a couple of months by Meir Soloveitchik's Zayin Gesund. That's the Brisker Rav's son, the Rav's first cousin. So he was Meir Shashiv in Yerushalayim, and I had a chavrusa with, I was there to have a chavrusa with Velva Soloveitchik, and Chaim Soloveitchik, the Meir's sons. So I remember I was learning with Chaim Soloveitchik, with the Reb Chaim, today's already Magid Shir. So I was learning with Reb Chaim, and... So we were learning, and we were learning Me'ila at the time. We were learning Me'ila, Kachem. And we were learning Sugi, and I was, like, talking, and, like, we were asking. And like, at some point, like, I remember I was asking questions, and something didn't sit well, and I was asking. And then, like, I said, I didn't even remember what the question was, but I'm like, wait, but X, Y, and Z. So he says, the Zeidot Gefrek the Kasha. He says, the Brisker Rav asked the question. So you know, anyone that learned in yeshiva, when you ask a question that somebody previously asked, what do you say? What do you say if you merited to ask Baruch a question? Baruch Shekivanti. So I said, oh, Baruch Shekivanti. So he gave me a look of disdain and he said, nein, du hast nicht mechaven gewen. Du hast nicht gefragte kasha, du hast gewundert das. He said to me, Baruch Shekivanti means blessed the one that guided me. So he says, you didn't ask the question that my grandfather asked. You like meandered onto it. He said, my grandfather asked that question, but you didn't ask the question. Just like a wundertaza. You wandered onto the question, you know. And that was so key. He's right. There's something as asking a question. You know, you ask a question, but there's something like you're sort of like, you know, slowly, you know, you're like wandering and, you know, and slowly you stumble upon the question. It's not the same thing. And that's why it's interesting. The Rebbe of Shab, in Samach Vav, in a famous Maimer, the Rebbe Rashab, the fifth Rebbe Lubavitch, he says an interesting thing. Just again, this is as a preface of why I'm bringing Heidegger into this, into the mix. You all know the famous Gemara that says, Talmud Bavli. In the Talmud Bavli, what does the Gemara itself call itself?
Darkness.
Darkness, right? Remember the Gemara? The Gemara brings a pasuk in Eicha, in Lamentations. B'machshakim o'yishivani k'meisei oylam. In Eicha, we say, on Tisha B'Av, we say, he sat me in darkness like the dead of the world. B'machshakim o'yishivani. And says the Gemara, B'machshakim o'yishivani, he sat me in darkness, zu Talmud Dushal Bavli. That's the Babylonian Talmud.
That's funny.
You never heard that Gemara before?
No, I like it.
You like it, right? The Bavli is called Machshakim HaYishivani, sat me in darkness, as opposed to the Yerushalmi, which is a lot more clear. The Yerushalmi just says halachas. There's not so much the pilpul and shakavatari and questions and answers and the ganze zach. So the Rebbe Shab is a whole mimer. So why do we use the Bavli? Why do we paskin like the Bavli? Halachic, we paskin like the Bavli. So if the Bavli itself is saying that it's Choshech B'machshakim HaYishivani, so why do we paskin like the Bavli? So the Rebbe Shab has a whole mimer where he says like this. Why is it, I'm sure you all know, clarity comes from questions, right? People that are afraid of questions mean they don't understand. Rule. Anyone that's afraid of being questions means they don't understand. Because clarity comes from questions, right? When that's what Chazal say, that a teacher learns from the students more than anyone else because of the questions. Why is it that why do questions bring clarity? Why? Let's think for a second. Let's go a little deeper. Why when you know an idea, I'm sure you've all had this experience, whether you're a teacher or not, you know an idea, you know something, but then when you're questioned and you're forced to find an answer, you know the idea more with more clarity. Why? Why do you think that is?
It forces you to think about what you're telling people, what you're saying, what your understanding of it is.
It forces you to look deeper, to take a step back into yourself and look at it better. The Rebbe Shab gives a mashal, like with wine. How do you make wine pure? You have to put it through a filter to strain it, the sediments out. Now, before you put it through the filter, there were sediments in it, but if you would have drank in it, you might not have, unless you were a connoisseur, you might not have tasted it. Because it's so mixed into the wine, you don't feel the psilus. But when you put it through the filter, you take out, it becomes more refined. Same thing the Rebbe Shab says, if you think about it in your mind, we have a lot of ideas in our mind about Judaism, about who we are, a lot of things. Only when you're challenged, think about it for a second, that you're challenged, you first to take a step back and re-examine and ask, when the question is asked, you have to take a step back and look at it clearly, the idea that you had in your mind. And then you strain it and you put it through a filter. Because so often we have ideas in our mind and, you know, it's just ideas that are there and we don't really examine it well. That's what Socrates says, that an examined life is not worth living, because you might be living it, but if you don't examine it, you don't really see what it is that you're doing or who you are. It's only by examining it that you see really who you are and what you're doing. Questions force you to examine better. So asking the right question is already half an answer, because when you ask the question properly, when you have the question clearly, so then you can really appreciate better what the answer is. So the Rav is saying to us, he has a question here, what does it mean, the loneliness that a man of faith has to experience? Now, I believe that to understand the question better is by comparing to the way the same issue that's understood from a secular philosophical standpoint. In other words, to understand because it could very well be that many of us are reading what the Rav is saying and wondering, what does that mean to me? I mean, do I feel that loneliness? Do I not feel that loneliness? What is this question that, number one, technology, number two, the narcissism, and number three, the fact that the world is so empirically and sensibly based, how much does that really affect me in my daily life? And the Rav is posing it as a question. And what I want to learn together is this essay from Heidegger that seems to be posing the exact same question. In other words, if you say that the Rav's question is, how does the man of faith function into the contemporary technological society? So we have to take a step back and say, one second, Heidegger, who is, you know, one of the greatest philosophers ever, arguably, he says the exact same question in the beginning of the 20th century, and he asked, how does man function in contemporary technological society? So, but if Heidegger is asking, how could man deal with contemporary technological society, and the Rav is asking, how does the man of faith deal with contemporary technological society, So what we need to do is understand what's the Rav asking differently than Heidegger. Because the Rav is saying that man of faith has a problem with contemporary society. But if other secular philosophers are saying that all men have a problem with contemporary society, so maishna, as the Bavli would say. I forgot to mention that. That's what the Rebbe Shab says. That's why we learn Bavli. I forgot to put it back. Why the Rebbe Shab says, why do we learn Bavli if it's such darkness? If there's so much questions and conundrums and pilpul, the Rebbe Shab says, because that's the filter. It's the questions, it's the darkness that makes you examine again. Here's the halacha, the Yerushalmi says. The Bavli says, no, but what do you mean? Maishna, what, how do you compare it to this? How does it fit with this? And then by doing that, what's called silsul halachas by alibas, asuka shmaitz alibas dilchas, so that by comparing halachas and comparing sugyas, then you have a clarity. You could say, how does this fit? How does the fact that this fits in hilchas brachas? In hilchas brachas, we say that an apple and chicken cannot fit together to make a bar nefashas. And in Yom Kippur, they do fit together to make you chayiv. So you say, oh, you know why? Because in brachas, it's a din of making a bracha on the food. Yom Kippur, it's a din of you being satiated. So it doesn't matter what the food is. And each time, which you all know, that's what lumdus is. You get a clarity from the darkness, from the questions, from the maishna. So what we need to do is make a maishna. If Heidegger is saying, if philosophers, if secular philosophers are also being bothered by contemporary society, nothing to do with faith, nothing to do with religion. And yet they speak about the fact that there's a danger in secular contemporary society, and he calls it the question of technology, the danger of technology. And he has a whole essay saying it, and he has this question about the danger we have to ask ourselves. So what's the Rav saying that man of faith, maishna, what's the difference? How is man of faith different? What's the philosophy that the Rav is trying to say? Now, all of us in this room believe that Rav Soloveitchik was also one of the greatest philosophers of the 20th century. And I hope that we don't just think that because we're subjective, because we're frum and he had a beard. I think we all really believe that Rav Soloveitchik had something to say in philosophy. He was a philosopher. We believe that. Otherwise, we wouldn't be getting together and reading this book, learning this book together. We wouldn't be having a shir in this book. We believe that he was a real philosopher and he had what to say. And in the Rav's philosophy, saying that man of faith is challenged by a technically minded, self-centered society. But Heidegger says the same thing. So we need to go together through this essay and see the way Heidegger poses the question, compare it to the way the Rav poses the question, and then we're going to have to compare the answers as well. Yeah, Ellie.
Doesn't a man of faith have a little easier than a man of no faith?
You're saying that B'chal, a man of faith, has it even easier than a man of no faith.
I think it has it easier because in the context of everything, if I believe there's a God, then there's at least somebody who's in charge. A man with no faith, this is all...
Well, you're assuming, let's get clear, you're assuming, that's what I'm saying, we have to be careful. In your question is an assumption that the contemporary society's issue is that there's no one in charge. But maybe that's not the problem. That maybe you are used to feeling that without someone in charge, it's a problem. Right? Maybe that's your reality. In your world, if there's no one in charge, that's a problem. But we'll see that Heidegger doesn't say that that's the issue. Secular philosophy doesn't have a problem with that. Secular people said that the issue is not that there's no one in charge. You're projecting, and I'm with you in the same boat, but we feel, what do you mean, if there's no one in charge, well, we're really messed up. But secular man doesn't feel that. Secular man is very comfortable with no one being in charge. That's not the problem. That's exactly what I'm saying, why it's important to learn this essay, to speak over this essay from Heidegger, to be able to say... Like Reb Chaim Soloveitchik said to me, not to meander, to stumble upon a question, but to be able to define what's the Rav saying man of faith's issue is, what's Heidegger saying contemporary man's issue is, and how do they compare? What?
It's an issue of meaning, right? They're struggling with that. Is that the underlying issue?
You're saying that you're understanding that contemporary man's problem is of course just a question of meaning. Okay, I hear you.
Meaning, I thought that's what he was saying when he said the man of faith has a little bit more to go with.
But you're saying the issue of Kandarina, there's no one in charge. You're saying there's no meaning. How is that the same?
It's the same thing.
Is it?
I thought that's different. No, that's why when you said that, I didn't.
One second, Heve, I'm asking you, having someone in charge.
It's more like there's a purpose.
Or having meaning is not the same thing. It's not the same thing.
I go with the meaning more.
Right, that's why I thought you were.
There's also an added thing, according to the Rav. Possibly, it's a much greater problem being a man of faith, only because inherent in being a man of faith, there always has to be doubt. In other words, that's why we paskin like, that's why we learn the Bavli and not the Yerushalmi, because there is always a question of doubt. There's always a question. We always have to ask that question. And because we always have to ask the question, there's always a doubt. A question, by virtue of the fact there's a question, there is a doubt. And that causes the lonely man of faith to have that problem.
Which doubt are you referring to?
Any doubt.
Do you think contemporary men, secular men, don't have doubt?
No, that's what...
They might not doubt. Maybe
that, that is the common denominator.
But first of all, okay, but I'm saying, do you think secular people don't live with doubt? Maybe they're agnostic when it comes to God, and maybe they do have doubt when it comes to God. But other than that, there was one of the greatest movies I ever saw. It was a play, and it was a Broadway show. It was made into a movie with Meryl Streep and Philip Seymour Hoffman called Doubt. You ever see it? It's a movie called Doubt with Meryl Streep and Philip Seymour Hoffman. It is one of the greatest movies I ever saw. It is such a deep movie. It was a show. If anyone ever wants to spend a worthwhile evening, Meryl Streep is godless. But that movie Doubt, the nakud of that movie. Meryl Streep plays a nun that thinks she has her act together and has no doubt. And the bottom line of the movie and the message of the movie is that doubt is part of the human condition. There's no such thing as a person that doesn't live with doubt. There's no such thing. We from people think that, maybe we feel ourselves insecure, that we're the ones that have doubt and we have to struggle. Everyone struggles with doubt. People struggle with doubt about a million things.
No, so that's what I'm saying. That's the inherent being of faith. Is that?
But I'm saying it's not just about faith. People have doubt about a million things.
Not in Google society.
I don't know if that's true. That's what I'm saying to you. I think the doubt is a part of the human condition. People doubt themselves all the time. People could be 30 years a lawyer and doubting, is this who I really am? Or people could doubt, is this the person I'm supposed to be with? People could, doubt all the time, did I do the right thing to my children? Did I act correctly? Did I say the right thing to my father before he passed away? People live with doubt all the time.
I understand, but that, in contemporary society's being, essence, is forever explaining, forever on, there's an off. Everything is is a technological question that is always answered.
Okay.
While faith, for every answer to a question, there's another question.
So that's what the Rav said. The Rav was saying that the loneliness of contemporary man of faith is living in a world where everything is defined by the laboratory, etc., etc., etc. Not that they don't live by doubt, but that the faith gesture, faith, which by which he lives, cannot be proven in a laboratory, etc. And the Rav is saying, therefore, he has the contemporary man of faith, because he lives in such a world, there's a special type of loneliness. But what I'm saying, what I want to do now is say that contemporary man that is not just a man of faith, secular man also has a problem living in contemporary society. And that's exactly the point that I'm saying, is that if he doesn't have the problem of faith, and yet the Heidegger has a whole essay and all the philosophers spoke about that contemporary man is in a crisis, so what exactly is the difference? How do you quantify, how do you show exactly what's the difference of the crisis of man of faith in contemporary society and other men in contemporary society? That's exactly what I'm saying. What talk is the difference?
Have we read so far anywhere that the world has a problem? Were challenged by...
That's what the first page he said in this preface.
He says that he's a lonely man of faith.
Right.
Does he say that he's actually... that he finds this a challenge?
That he finds a challenge? That faith itself is a challenge?
That he himself... That he's a lonely man of faith. That meaning, does he accept the fact that he's just a lonely man of faith and that's the way men of faith are, that they're going to always be lonely? Or is he saying that there is a... Because society is what it is and we are what we are, lonely men of faith, presumably you are... That we have a problem with that.
Those are the two sides of the coin we learned about last week. Yeah. Both of what you said.
And are they problematic, though?
Nachmo, that's the, what are the two sides of the coin, Lenny? The first side of the coin we said was the ontological loneliness by virtue of it being a man of faith.
Mm-hmm.
Second one is living in society.
In society.
So both cause loneliness.
Accepted.
Right.
I accept that there's loneliness. Does loneliness mean negative? Is there a negative to being lonely?
You don't. He said in the very first page. He said
caused a dilemma,
he caused a dilemma. He was. You remember the words he said? He said. personal dilemma.
Mm-hmm.
He said, I want to share with you, confide in you, concerns which weigh heavily on my mind, which frequently assume the proportions of an awareness of crisis.
Mm-hmm.
That was the very first page. He said, I have no problem solving thoughts. That was the whole preface, is that he feels he's sharing with us, he's a tormented soul that finds peace in confessing.
Uh-huh.
The Rav over here is very, very tormented in a crisis.
Because some people are very happy being lonely.
Again, we spoke about the difference between being alone
not
and
alone.
Being lonely.
I said lonely. I meant lonely.
Really?
Yeah, I think some people are very, comfortable being...
alone.
Okay, so the word lonely itself means something...
I think so. Very negative, I believe.
Something bad.
I think so.
Mm-hmm. I guess, yeah.
So let's summarize. What I'm saying is that in order to have the clarity of what our problem is supposed to be, we have to see how a secular philosopher says what is a secular person's problem in contemporary society, and then we could say Maishna. what would be our difference? So I'm going to go through with you this essay from Heidegger. Now, first of all, it does need to be mentioned why I chose Heidegger. First of all, because he is one of the most famous essays on technology. So it does need to be mentioned. My good friend and over here, Yaakov Gershel. So he would not ever forgive me if I didn't say that. I would have mentioned it anyway. Don't worry, it's not for you. But of course, Heidegger is a very controversial philosopher. He was a member of the Nazi Party. So that for us it definitely poses an issue. And he had certain writings that are anti-Semitic, but he was not. It is controversial the whole world because of that. But first of all, it needs to be said. Number one, first and foremost, Kabbalah emes misha amar. First and foremost. Emes, you have to take from who says it. The Gemara learns out from Psukim that Bilam said. The Gemara learns out from the Nevuas of Bilam. The Gemara learns out from Psukim that Haman said. Gansa drushes. Tell me, why is the yant of a Purim called Purim? Because of what Haman did. And we spelled Mamorim explaining what's the deeper meaning of what Haman did, what Paro said. Emes is Emes. Truth has to be objective. That's number one. Number two, Heidegger himself, again, I'm not going to get into the whole issue, but he very quickly distanced himself from the party. He was very quickly disillusioned from the party. He was not involved with openly anti-Semitic activity.
Oh.
The fact that he wrote anti-Semitic things, so did Shakespeare, so did Henry Ford. We're not going to not use cars because Henry Ford was anti-Semitic, and we're not going to not go to Disneyland because Walt Disney was anti-Semitic. That's an old issue. But he very much distanced himself from the party, and to judge a person that was living in Germany at that time, Being part in the Nazi Party at that time, there was such peer pressure. Again, we're not condoning it, but certainly you can't completely disqualify a person based on that. And second of all, today, especially today, that everyone knows that who is Martin Heidegger's lifelong deepest connection, most romantic and intimate
Hannah
connection,
Arendt.
Was Hannah Arendt, was a Jewish woman. So therefore, we know that he obviously did not agree with Hitler's final solution. But other than that, so that he is a person of controversy, it goes without saying. But he is still, at the end of the day, he's also known as arguably one of the greatest philosophers of the 20th century. And what makes it very interesting, and specifically one of the other reasons, is that Heidegger had two students. One of them's name was Rav Soloveitchik, and the other's name was Lubavitcher Rebbe. So Lushkin actually writes in his book, the Joseph Lushkin's biography of the Rebbe, so he writes there an anecdote. And he actually quotes the source, who he heard it from. He heard it from or someone that heard it from the Rav. If you look in Telushkin's book, you can look in the index, he quotes there an anecdote that Telushkin himself heard from someone that heard it from the Rav's mouth. That that the Rav said over, Rav Soloveitchik said that he said over that one time he remembers he and the Lubavitcher Rebbe was sitting in Heidegger's lecture. You can imagine that picture, Heidegger lecturing.
Wait.
And the Lubavitcher Rebbe, what? What's the issue?
Didn't Heidegger taught in Freiburg, not Berlin?
He would guest lecture in Berlin as well, of course. His main position was, of course, in Marburg and Freiburg, but he lectured in Berlin as well. So the so imagine that picture that Heidegger is saying a lecture in the Lubavitcher Rebbe. At that time he was not the Rebbe, but and the Rav is sitting in his class, and the Rav said that the Rebbe was learning Tanya. This is what it says in the book, that the Rebbe was sitting and learning Tanya. And the Rav said that after the class, he went over to the Rebbe and he said, what's the point of sitting in a lecture if you're going to be learning Tanya? And the Rebbe said over to him everything that Heidegger said, all the ideas that Heidegger said. And the Rav said, again, this is based on what the book says, that the Rav the following class came with a Gemara and he tried to do the same. And he said he was not able to follow the lecture. He wasn't able to follow. That the Rav had an unbelievable respect for the Rebbe, everyone knows, and the Rebbe had an unbelievable respect for the Rav. I don't know if you know this, but in over 40 years that the Rebbe verbrenged, 40 years, there was only one time that the Rebbe stood up in the middle of a verbrenging for somebody. A lot of very holy chasheva people came to Rebbe's verbrengings, Rosh Hashivas and Rabbanim and government people. The Rebbe would never, he was the Rebbe, he wouldn't, there was one time he stood up, and that was when the Rav came, Yud Shvat Tavshin Mem, in 1980, the Rav came to verbreng, the Rebbe stood up for him, and he wouldn't sit down until the Rav sat down. So they had tremendous respect for each other.
If I'm not mistaken, I think I saw that on YouTube.
Yeah,
yeah,
no,
yeah, it is on YouTube.
What's his name? Heschel Schaffer.
Right.
Yeah. So anyway, so the two of them, they both sat in Heidegger's class, and my contention is, I haven't written this up yet, but maybe if God will help one day I will, that they were both affected by Heidegger's philosophy, I believe. The Rav definitely quotes Heidegger, an halachic man, negatively to be sure, but it makes a lot of sense to say that there are some things that the Rav says where he's speaking to Heidegger, he's addressing Heidegger's philosophy. I do also think, and I know this would be certainly heresy in most Lubavitch circles to say what I'm about to say, but I very much believe the Rebbe's chassida, certain of the Rebbe's ideas about the essence and being of God, very much correlates with certain things that Heidegger says. Heidegger's whole philosophy was about being, and there are certain things that very much that you could say that there that
we're,
they
we're
connect.
A nation of heretics.
You know, that's for sure.
And if you're not, you should be.
Right. There's a quote from Thomas Merton that says that if you look back at who if the you who you were 5 years ago doesn't look at who you are today as a heretic, you've not grown.
That's Rav Hutner.
Yeah?
Rav Hutner was asked. This is a famous anecdote. Rav Hutner was asked by a Talmud that at the 20 years after he started writing his Ma'amarim, he says, but that conflicts with what you wrote in your first Ma'amar. He said, if I believe now what I did then, says, then nothing makes sense.
Then it's not worth living. Yeah, 100%. People that live with the same, you know, same mind frame in Yiddishkeit is the exact same as it was 10 years before. We have to be growing, 100%. Yeah. So let's go through this essay. So like this. So first he begins. It's too long, so I'm just going to summarize the main thrust of the essay. He begins by saying that we note, Heidegger says, that the name of the essay is The Question Concerning Technology. And Heidegger begins by saying that in order to have what he calls a free relationship to technology, we have to define first what is the essence of technology. In other words, in order, he says, everywhere we remain unfree and chained to technology, whether we passionately affirm or deny it. Heidegger is saying that the only way to not be chained and enslaved to technology, because he's going to say what he says, the danger of technology and contemporary society, again, technology which is the overriding theme of the contemporary society, he says we remain unfree and chained to technology whether we passionately affirm or deny it. And the only way we'll be able to free ourselves from it is if we define what the essence of technology is. Now, some of us might be sitting here and thinking, we're not chained to technology.
What was technology for him? When was this written?
This originally given in 1949, and was then written again in 1954. Mm-hmm. So this is after World War II. So some of us might be sitting here and saying, well, we don't feel chained to technology. So yeah, I mean, what Rabbi Weinberg of Moshe Tzvi is saying, I mean, anyone here have an iPhone and not feel chained to it, to your smartphone? So right. So I think we being chained to a smartphone is bechlal the best example to, right? But even in Heidegger's day, he was saying that people could think, well, I'm not chained to technology. People
radio
that,
and television just came out, you know.
Electricity.
Yeah.
Well, we'll see. You'll be shocked. You'll be shocked when you'll see what he says. How deep the being chained and being enslaved is It's not just even electricity. You'll see. It's things that we're so not aware. What I was going to say is, a person that that doesn't feel that they're chained is the one that's most in prison. You know that, right? A person that doesn't know that they're in prison is the most in prison. You all know that. That's the scariest thing. When a person doesn't even realize that there's a problem. That's the person that's most chained, right? The person that the first step of an addict, and I actually just recently, literally a couple of weeks ago, I attended my first Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. Not for myself. Don't worry. It's obviously not working, right? Right, not for myself.
That's what they always say. It's my friend here.
Yeah, it's my friend. Some of my best friends are Jews, right? Yeah. Yeah, so for a person that I went that actually received a medallion, I think she was 15 years without a drink. Now, so I never knew, I never went into the mind frame of alcoholics. But anyone that knows that it's mamish, a sickness. And the worst part is that many of them don't even realize that it's a sickness. And being chained to something and not realizing that it's a problem is the worst. That's the worst. So Heidegger says that everywhere we remain unfree and chained to technology, whether we passionately affirm or deny it. And the only way he says that we're going to be able to get out of it is by defining what the problem is, by realizing how enslaved we are. And what he's going to say is that the problem is not in technology. The problem is going to be in our orientation to technology. Technology has completely changed the way we're oriented to society, that we're oriented to reality. And I'm telling you, it's going to be shocking when we learn this to see, because some of us are not even going to realize it's going to be very eye-opening to see how our orientation to life is so affected by technology. And again, I don't even mean the iPhone. That over here, Yaakov Gershel is sitting here next to me listening to class on his iPhone, right? I'm not even talking about that.
I'm looking up because I'm sorry to interrupt, but I distinctly remember learning in college that Heidegger actually specifically kicked out Husserl for being a Jew out of school and purposely went through the list of professors and found all the Jews and said, you have to leave. And you said that it was just flirting.
I
was trying to see if
you know that that's not the point of tonight's class, and it's not worthwhile getting too much into that.
That's true. I was just trying to see if I was right, but I can't find it.
So you're not, because Husserl was Heidegger's teacher, and he was fired. And the taina on Heidegger is, again, I'm sorry that I don't want to get into this, but the taina on Heidegger is that he took his teacher's position, that he became the rector, that he took his teacher's position, even though Husserl was kicked out for being a Jew. But not that he literally kicked him out. But let's try to focus on what we're learning.
Okay?
But that just shows you how chained. Yaakov just demonstrated for us just how chained to technology we are. Anyway, so he says, so Heidegger says that the worst is when we see technology as something neutral, and we're blind to the essence of technology, then we're enslaved to it, because we can't define what the problem is. The cure is by first knowing what the problem is. So he says, first of all, one will say, so let's say, what's the essence of technology? So if I ask you, what is technology? So Heidegger goes, what would you say? What is technology? What would you say? How would you define it? What would you say?
Things that make our lives easier.
Oh, a tool, utilitarian tool that we use to make our lives easier. Right? It's a tool. A tool, utilitarian tool that we use to make our lives easier. So Heidegger says, who would ever deny that is correct? It's correct. But the merely correct is not yet the true. It's correct to say that technology is a tool we use to make our lives easier, but the merely correct is not yet the true. Only the true brings us into a free relationship with that which concerns us from its essence. In other words, truth is not just to say that something is correct. Truth is when you know the essence of what things are. Because if we just define technology as a tool used to make our lives easier, who's in charge? Us or technology? Us. If we're still like saying, yeah, technology is harmless, it's just a tool, that's correct, but that's being blind to what the essence of technology is and just saying that we don't know what its essence is, and therefore we're blind to what it really is and we don't realize that we're enslaved to it, right? I don't remember offhand, but what's the name of that book? I forgot the name. There was a book where there's like a whole society of people that were like made into function just to be like, to build up the society, and they didn't even realize. They like completely lost and the giver? Was that what the lowest? A whole book of people that they lost they made slaves to something, but they don't know about it, so they're happy. Right? So, you know, it's interesting, just to give you an example, you ever wonder,
if they're happy, what's wrong with that?
Right, what's wrong with that taka? Because ignorance is bliss. You ever think of the French Revolution, which we know historically nothing changed history and society that we live in the world like French Revolution. Everything that we live in today is a result of the French Revolution. Everything. And I'm talking about everything in contemporary society as a result from that revolutionary ideas. Now, the French Revolution, so you all remember Madame Defarge and Tale of Two Cities and the horrible state and Les Miserables or whatever, even though Les Miserables was after the French Revolution, but you all remember that the situation of that, you know, today they say the 1% has 90, how much percent of the wealth in America, but people are still living okay. Back then, the peasants were living in filth for hundreds of years. Hundreds of years. So what happened by the... Why did they storm the Bastille in 1789? What happened until then? What happened until then? For hundreds of years, the peasants were living in a way of filth and they were slaves to the king. So like you say, Lenny, well, they were happy. Why were they happy? What changed? Knowledge. That's exactly what it was. It was Voltaire. It was the Enlightenment. And it was all of a sudden people thought differently. So as long as you don't think differently, you're okay. So what Heidegger is saying is that the danger is that we're enslaved to technology. He's going to say what that means, and we think that's okay because we don't have the knowledge of realizing that it's a problem. We're not even aware that we're enslaved. So he says like this. So that's what he's going to find. So what's the essence of technology, and thereby understanding why? What does it mean that we live that our whole orientation is enslaved to that? And essentially, I just want to say again, getting back to Lonely Men of Faith, what Heidegger is going to define is that the philosophical issue of contemporary society is that man has lost being true to himself by being enslaved to technology. That's what he's going to say. Man has lost what it means to be true to himself. And so again, what we need to understand is how is Heidegger defining how contemporary society has alienated man from himself? And then we could understand how the Rav is saying how man of faith has a completely different problem from contemporary society. So let's just begin. I know it's already late. I think we do need to stop over here because this is already opening thing. But again, so basically, we'll stop here. So Heidegger is going to define what does it mean that we're enslaved to technology? How has technology completely changed our orientation to reality to a way that we're not even realizing, we're not even aware of it? And how is that going to be different from man of faith's issue? That's the goal that we're going to do. Because to learn Lonely Man of Faith thoroughly and properly, we need to really define, not just meander and say, oh yeah, because whatever. What is regular man's problem with society, and what's man of faith's problem with it? We'll continue this from next week. Now, before I go further, yeah.
Does Heidegger use the phraseology stranger, or like the Rav does? I mean, does he feel that he's a stranger to society, like the Rav feels that he's a stranger to society?
I don't want to give away the punchline because I want you to come back next week. Stay tuned. But what he's going to say is that technology makes us a stranger to ourselves. That we're not in touch with ourselves, really.
And according to him, what is the essence of oneself?
That's what we're going to read. He uses
the word. He says stranger. He does use other words.
Does Heidegger use the word stranger?
Does he use other words to describe stranger? I mean,
the word Heidegger is going to use
alien
is that
or something that
it's a different
makes
language
you
also.
Feel different.
Man stands so decisively. I'm now going to paraphrase: enslaved to technology, and now I quote: he can never encounter only himself. So he doesn't use the word stranger, but he says that man can never encounter oneself. That's what he's going to say. Now, so that's the end of this. Now, what I just want to spend a couple of minutes doing, I'm going to shut the recording over here because it's not the...